This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and Vantage Health Plan provide signature support for our program. We start with David A. Kaplan, senior editor and legal affairs correspondent at Newsweek for 20 years. While there, he wrote several dozen cover stories on the Supreme Court and other topics, later contributing editor at Fortune, where his long-form profiles became a staple of that magazine. And we will talk with him about a few matters, but the matter most pressing right now in our country is the opening on the Supreme Court, with Ruth Bader Ginsburg dying last Friday, age 87. And of course, the nation is in mourning for a person who is even receiving plaudits from her fiercest foes from the political spectrum, but she was a gallant person and a great example of what it means to be an American. David A. Kaplan's book is The Most Dangerous Branch, Inside the Supreme Court's Assault on the Constitution. And good morning to you, David A. Kaplan.
Good morning. I'm always struck by how political opponents are so kind to those they hate, but only after they die.
Only after they die. But Ginsburg, she and Scalia were friends, which is weird, but they actually liked each other. They didn't vote. They basically
canceled. They shared a love of opera, and I think they also believed in the project and the mission that the Supreme Court was. And I mean, there are a lot of examples in the court's history where rivals become friends, but of course there are also there are other examples where rivals didn't talk to each other for decades. So the Scalia-Ginsburg example was sort of neat and indicates that collegiality and respect can still work even if you have diametrically opposed views.
My impression, David, is that you had a more favorable view of Justice Ginsburg than you did Justice Scalia.
You know, it all depends. My book is, so I'm told, is an equal opportunity offender. Liberals hate part of it. Conservatives hate part of it. My own wife doesn't like half of it. So, you know, I in some respects, I think that means I did a good job. My argument in the book is that the court simply has become too interventionist, too triumphalist for 50 years, you know, the modern era. And that's not good for liberals, and that's not good for conservatives. I think Ginsburg, though, so to answer your question, I think Ginsburg did a better job of trying to respect the other branches of government, Congress, state legislatures. I think she truly tried to exercise judicial restraint, that old saw. She did so on occasion. She was a minimalist. She herself, for years, criticized Roe v. Wade, saying it went too far, too fast. Whereas I think Justice Scalia, though a far better writer than Justice Ginsburg, was a hypocrite. You know, Justice Scalia would talk about observing, judging based on the text of the Constitution. And yet, in the most infamous Supreme Court decision of our era, Bush v. Gore, 20 years ago, awarding the presidency to George Bush, Scalia decisively moved in to decide the election, when, of course, the Supreme Court should have stayed a million miles away from that ruling. And when asked about it after the ruling, he would say, "We were the laughingstock of the world." I went out and checked my Constitution right after he said that, and I just couldn't find any text about laughingstock of the world. It was the classic instance where the court should have stayed away, and they didn't. And it just proved that the so-called conservatives are every bit as interventionist as they claim the liberals are.
Well, and in that case, which was 5-4, literally five justices stopped Albert Gore from becoming president. Two of the justices...
Well, I think that they stopped the counting. One of the great ironies of Bush v. Gore is, I think, had the counting continued and there was, and you had split verdicts, if you will, in Florida, and you had different slates of electors going to the Electoral College, the case ultimately would have been, the dispute would have been, it would have gone to Congress, as the Constitution calls for. It doesn't call for the Supreme Court to resolve the case. And if that would have happened, I think George Bush would have been declared president by the House of Representatives. But since the Senate determines the vice presidency, there's a chance that Joe Lieberman might have been declared vice president. I think that would have struck much of the country as rough justice. You would have had the first, if you will, coalition government in American history. In any event, mm-hmm. it would have been decided in the way the system set up. So, no, I don't think under any scenario Al Gore would have become president.
Well, you and others would disagree on that because we know Gore was within 537 votes. And the Supreme Court stopped it for a reason. They stopped it because they feared he might become president of the United States.
Right.
And you say it probably wouldn't have happened anyway, but they did intervene. And these people who favor states' rights, in this case.
Well, I think Gore might have pulled ahead. I'm just not sure that the Republicans in control of the levers of government in Florida mm-hmm. would have honored that in the electors they sent up. You know, there were recounts. We're discussing ancient history, which, of course, may be more fun than discussing what's about to happen this weekend. But the recounts that were done by the media and academics long after 2000 show that if all the votes, if you will, had been counted in the four counties that Al Gore wanted counted, Bush would have prevailed. But if all the votes in the whole state had been counted, which Al Gore never asked for, then Al Gore would have won. So there are a lot of ironies in that case. And, of course, Bush v. Gore could never happen again. It was a one-off in American history. Oh, wait a second. We may have Bush v. Gore on steroids in a month.
Well, that
was one state. Imagine if there are 10 battleground states where we're fighting about mailed-in ballots and absentee ballots, and the court, whether it's mm-hmm. at 8 justices or 9, may have to face down this disaster again. And it will be interesting to see if they learned anything from the nightmare and disaster that Bush v. Gore was.
877-217-5757 and talk@talklouisiana.org for David A. Kaplan, one of the most seasoned and talented journalists in our land. Teaches at NYU, by the way, the most dangerous branch inside the Supreme Court's assault on the Constitution. Now, to hearken back to Bush v. Gore one more time, people may forget that at that time, David, there were 7 justices on the court appointed by Republican presidents, and Gore actually snagged 2 of the 7 and Souter and Stevens to go on his side. And this time around, we're all hot and bothered about possibly having 6 justices appointed by Republican presidents. Why are we more troubled now than we were then?
Well, I am. I'm not sure others are. But I think the answer is because in the intervening 20 years, the court has consistently, in the big cases, indicated or at least seemed like it's just a proxy for the political party of the presidents who appointed them. You know, the gun control ruling in 2008, called Heller, the Shelby County ruling in 2013 that gutted the Voting Rights Act, Citizens United that unleashed big money into campaigns in 2010, all of them were voted along, if you will, party lines. And that's really bad for the court because it looks like it's captive to political interests. If all the Supreme Court is a political agent of Republicans and Democrats, why have the court to begin with? Why do you want 9 unelected, unaccountable judges who serve for life making these decisions? Republicans and Democrats are both guilty of seeing the court that way. And we all are assuming now that whoever Trump appoints is going to, quote unquote, vote conservative. And that's probably right, because that's how the nominee's going to be chosen. It wasn't always so. Once upon a time, we sometimes made some effort to put the best legal minds on the country who aspired to making decisions neutrally based on the rule of law. Of course, politics entered into it, but not to the degree that it does now. It is a much more fine-tuned own process now than it used to be. You can applaud that both parties are more efficient at playing the game, but I would argue they've just gotten better at being bad.
David A. Kaplan with us. And before we go to the break, a listener asked about the prospect of what you just mentioned, several states being contested over mail-in ballots and it going to the Supreme Court, and that sixth justice being a conservative. Is there a real concern that Donald Trump may this time lose not only the overall vote, but lose the Electoral College and still retain the presidency?
Well, you know, the question is whether he loses the Electoral College. If he loses the Electoral College and all decision makers, all those who judge such things agree, including the Supreme Court, he won't become president. The issue is going to be which electors are honored. And the Supreme Court may decide very differently than what, for example, Democratic states below have decided.
So the electors could be tampered with, if you will, and the outcome could be changed. We'll talk some more with David Kaplan after this 90-second pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle producing, and a few more minutes with David A. Kaplan, who has a timely book. He hit it right as far as timely. His book is The Most Dangerous Branch, Inside the Supreme Court's Assault on the Constitution. Before we go to a call or two, a listener asked how many of the justices who are there for Bush v. Gore are still around. And David, I think it's just Breyer and Thomas. I think they're just two left. Is that correct?
I'm thinking I'm just running through the roster. I guess that's right.
Yeah, just two out of the nine. Nine, presuming that the other seat is filled by the time this potentially goes to the high court in a Trump contesting of the election. This is amazing that an incumbent president is all but conceding that he's going to lose the election, but that he has a way to get around that. It is unprecedented.
Well, I mean, Trump just mouths off, and I largely discount most things that he says, worrisome that they are. He, of course, also understands nothing about the way courts work or how the Supreme Court works. And the Supreme Court decides its own docket. You don't get to appeal a case there as a matter of right. And it's hardly a certainty, it seems to me, particularly after the experience of Bush v. Gore, that the Supreme Court will go anywhere near electoral disputes in lower courts. Maybe. They were arrogant 20 years ago. They may be arrogant again. But I would think, particularly given how Bush v. Gore haunts that building, that there might be more reluctance and they might learn. It really depends. Mm-hmm. The problem also for Trump is that the disputes that come to the court could be from both sides. If you if you want to second guess what lower court or state election commissions are doing, well, you know, some are going to be ruling the Democratic way, if you will, and some will be ruling the Republican way. Unless the Supreme Court just wants to look like it's using constitutional law inconsistently to fine for Trump in each case, it's a lot harder for the Supreme Court to just say Trump wins. I guess on the parade of horribles that I worry about, the Supreme Court probably isn't at the top of the list. I worry more about what goes on in respective states that that incompetence doesn't allow votes to get counted. There is plenty of malevolence, Matt. We're seeing it played out among states. But there's also a lot of incompetence and terrible technology that hadn't been fixed in 20 years, as well as an overwhelmed postal service. So there's all manner of monkey wrenches that may be thrown into the process without even getting to the problem of the Supreme Court. And whether Trump gets his ninth justice or not, you know, if you're worried about partisanship or unfairness of the Supreme Court, they may already have five votes. It depends how much faith you have in Chief Justice John Roberts. Roberts has done, if you will, the right and cautious thing in a few cases, but don't confuse him for being a moderate. He is a resolute conservative and has been on the wrong side, for my taste, in any number of cases. And again, though I'm a political liberal, I'm probably a judicial moderate. And my objection to the Chief Justice isn't that he has conservative ideology. It's that in too many cases, he has the court. He votes for the court to get involved where it shouldn't. We discussed a few of those cases earlier.
Dan downtown. Oops, I think we just lost Dan. If you call back, we'll try to get you in before we part company. But Dan, trying to pose a question, good lawyer for David A. Kaplan. Another question from a listener is regarding the vacancy. Who do you think will be chosen or selected as the nominee by the president?
My predictions are usually wrong, although I got Brett Kavanaugh right. I think he's going to pick who everybody else thinks he's going to pick, Amy Coney Barrett. The 48-year-old federal judge who's been on the federal appellate bench in the Midwest for a couple of years before then. She was a Notre Dame law professor, once clerked for Justice Scalia.
And,
very bright, very smart. But, of course, she's not being chosen because she's very bright or very smart. She's being chosen because the White House believes she will vote the right way. And people shouldn't confuse the issue of paper qualifications with why they're being picked.
All right, Dan.
Trump was supposed to talk.
Okay, let's try to get Dan in. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with David A. Kaplan. You're going to have to pull Dan up. There we go.
Yeah,
Dan, good morning.
Mr. Kaplan, do the Democrats have anything equivalent to the Federalist Society, which makes sure nominees are young, right-wing ideologues?
They do. They have something called the American Constitution Society. But are they quite as well organized and motivated as the Federalist Society has been for nearly 40 years? Probably not quite yet. And I would imagine that if Joe Biden becomes president, he will rely more on an inner core of advisors to be making a decision. Part of the problem with Trump is he didn't have that inner core of advisors, so he had to outsource it to the Federalist Society.
The book is The Most Dangerous Branch, Inside the Supreme Court's Assault on the Constitution. We'll leave you with one more question from a listener, David A. Kaplan. Do you have a choice as one of your favorite justices in modern time?
I love my children equally. but, you know, sure. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of them. I interviewed a majority of them for the book on background. I can't tell you which ones. And I like some personally more as a personal matter more than others. But I think in modern times, my model justice would be Justice Harlan from the late 50s and into the 60s. Moderate, cautious, was a minimalist. For justices who people may have heard of more, I would say David Souter, who was appointed by the first George Bush, and Souter retired a decade ago. And on the current court, I would probably say Justice Breyer. Justice Breyer, though, you know, termed a liberal, has voted to defer to the will of Congress more than any other justice. And I think we need more of that from the court. That's not a liberal perspective or a conservative perspective. That's a modest perspective.
Well, it's an important book, and as mentioned, couldn't be more timely, from David A. Kaplan regarding the U.S. Supreme Court, where the action is the most dangerous branch. Thank you, David, and congratulations.
Thank you. My pleasure. Great questions from your audience.
Take care and see you soon.